This is a pretty good day for us because we're going to have a couple things. One, we've got some neat, exciting news from the front that y'all have been asking about for a long time, kind of the resource front. And then this is also probably my favorite topic to talk about. It can be very deeply philosophical, but it can also be very, very, I think, interesting for those who really want to get to know God, because it's the best launching point to getting to know God in the way that we talk about it in a religious sense. So this is going to be, I think today is a good day. We'll see how it turns out. So on the announcement front a couple times, we just posted this. Thanks. As you know, Lang has been for years doing terrific media work for us. And so we owe him a huge debt of gratitude that we can't pay all the classes and stuff that you guys have benefited from. Hopefully, all that recording has been done by Lang, and he's been doing it in an environment that, truth be told, will drive media people nuts, because it's none of this is built for that. In fact, it seems to be built for the exact opposite of good media production, and yet he's been adaptable and terrific and faithful and long-serving and all that kind of stuff. Eric, who volunteered his spare time, that, you know, when you try to describe great things about people, he drives a Tesla. So that, to me, I start there. And then anything else is downhill from that one, because it's a mixture of both the vision and courage, because you never know what that vehicle is going to do either in any sense. So. Anyway, Eric has stepped in and drug us all into the next century. And he has built the following website. We just posted this on our Facebook page, the Solid Ground Facebook page. We now have a Solid Ground website that, when you go to it, will give you this. This is probably what will come up when you first hit it, and it'll say first session, and we'll feed that in. But this right here is what you're seeing. So you hit play on that one. If you don't happen to be here, do it here now, because you'll just get a delayed version of this. I know you don't want to hear this twice in a row. So this is the place to do it. When we start putting resources down, the notes, the electronic kind of screen grabs, the stuff, the notes that we draw, when we do outlines, we're still exploring how to do outlines in a class that's very dynamic. It's not terribly easy to do. But all of those things will end up getting posted on that website as well, and then we'll also post resources, like when someone suggests Till We Have Faces to as a kind of a neat link. We'll put a set of links and resources in there as well. So that is being currently developed and built, but the website exists. There it is. It's hot and running, and this is where to find the webcast that's going on right now.
It was last time.
Anything else that I need, Eric, that I need to say about this site, or anything that you would say about it? Okay. Any questions about what it actually is? Eric's the man to talk to as well. For those two that are looking, had this question come up for kind of like notes, transcripts. Obviously, we're not doing that's pretty labor intensive right now. We don't have any intent to do that in the near future. But I think I've said, and I will continue to say, we are cribbing heavily from this website right here, this ministry, Reasonable Faith. This is Dr. Craig's website. Dr. Craig, some of you are familiar with, as being kind of a philosopher and a theologian who's kind of a world-class apologist. He is teaching a series at his home church called Defenders, which is very much the syllabus that we're following. Now, we depart from some of the way that he teaches and some of the information that he covers in here. Maybe not for a good reason, but if you miss a class, if you're looking for notes, if you want quick, if you want good professional expansion on the topics you're hearing in here, this is the place to go. So you'll see we're doing Doctrine of God today and Attributes of God. So if you click on this link, this is under his Defenders series. This is Defenders 3. They've got all the podcasts, they've got video, and the great thing they've got is they have his transcripts. So here's a transcript of the same topic that we're going to cover today, done by a professional dual PhD theologian philosopher with a world-class title. So I'll leave it to you, which is the better set of notes to read. However, this class is more fun. And I've challenged him to a one-on-one fight if he disagrees with that one, and he hasn't yet accepted. I didn't publish it yet, so maybe today's the first day. Just kidding. So today we are going to talk about something that I think is absolutely the starting point. I think ought to be the starting point for when you say, I want to know God. If there's a God out there, who is he? How do I get to know him? What are some data that I can know about him? This is the first bit. Now, although the topic roughly that we're talking about is called divine aseity, and aseity is simply the property of existing by and of itself. So on the dry philosophical side, which I happen to enjoy, I know some people in this class do enjoy, so we'll touch on it a little bit in here. It is the nature of necessity. It's what a necessary being is versus a contingent being. There's all this, modal logics that go into it, the logic of and nature of necessity go into it, analytic philosophy and non-synthetic logic go into it. So for those that are inclined in that direction, this is a very rich topic. But for the rest of us human beings that may not be as enamored with that, this topic has another key point to it. And that is, the launching point that I want to talk about it is God's name, who God says he is. So if we had talked last time about, we don't just want to know things about God, we want to know God. It's the difference between knowing about Tom Cruise and knowing Tom Cruise. So everyone here has seen Tom Cruise in a movie, and when you see him in person, you might say something like, "Hey, Tom, great to see you, blah, blah, blah." And what's he thinking when he looks at you? I have no idea who you are, right? Because you know something, you think you know something about him. We think we know something about him. We've watched him act. We've watched him work. Whether that's who he really is or not, we don't know. But it's the difference, but we may know a lot of things about him, but we don't know him unless you have some sort of personal relationship with him. Well, the same thing is true of God. You can see God's work the same way you can see Tom Cruise's work. Tom Cruise makes movies, God makes universes. Tom Cruise infuses his movies with action and drama and whatever else. God infuses his universe with beauty and subtlety and all the other things that you see around here as well. You can know things about each one of them by looking at their work, but if you really want to know them, you talk to them. Now, when we talk about God's name, we're going to go to the first book of the scriptures and the last book, at least in the way that they're ordered right now, in order to get some two key points about his name. But when we're talking about a name, don't forget how names used to be done, and especially in the context that we're doing. Right now, how do we pick names? Anybody want to say how they pick their child's name kind of thing?
Sort of use baby genius.
Yeah, you go to Google, you type in baby names, or you type in baby name meanings, and then you do something that has to do with it. If you've looked at the frequencies of baby, I've had to do this recently a few times because I'm a father of young children, and we've got another one, our first daughter due in May. And so we have looked through a whole bunch of, we had a naming convention. All right, so I'll talk a little bit about how we name our kids. We had a naming convention. Everybody that's in the military laughs because it's not alphanumeric. But they are, we basically said, let's do Old Testament saint, New Testament saint, or new, ancient Jewish saint, ancient Christian saint, our Scottish clan, McCrae, and then my last name, Tomlinson. So they all have four names in the anticipation that they want to be physicists or pretentious writers, because you need, S.L.A. Marshall as a philosopher or something like that, J.R.R. Tolkien. You have to have three. So Dumbledore had five. We've stopped one short of that one because we're muggles. The advantage of a naming convention is when you tell your children why they're named, it's not Jennifer. And if you tell somebody your name is Jennifer, there's a decent probability that you were born between something like 1972 and 1981, when that was the most popular name for a run of years. Jennifer was the most popular for the longest time since John and Mary. Prior to film and television, John and Mary had a lock. They were the most popular names. Then film stars started coming in, and all of a sudden everybody's named after film stars. So we had to break the naming convention for my daughter because Old Testament saint, there's not a lot of ladies' names that work really well in the Old Testament, and all the good ones, which there were a ton of them, were already taken. And my wife took needless exception to my suggestion, which was Jael, J-A-E-L. Anybody remember who she was? Yeah, she's the lady that killed the runaway king with a tent peg through the temple, and my wife thought that sent the wrong message. So there are struggles that we have in our marriage. They are real. Anybody has questions about that can come and talk to us afterwards. The naming convention didn't really work out, so we have gone with Sophia for the first name, meaning wisdom, and Aileen, which it looks like Eileen, but in Scottish, in Scotch Gaelic, it means of the light. So wisdom of the light. Seth is our firstborn son. We had actually lost a child to miscarriage earlier. Seth was a replacement, so that's some meaning in there. And then my old man's family, grandparents were pretty horrible people. Dad kind of pulled himself out of all that by his bootstraps and the grace of God. And then I have said, we want a new generation of righteous men. And so Seth, whose name means the father of the righteous. All right, so you can see that we have infused some meaning into it, but that's me. And my second son has the same kind of thing going on. Same set of naming conventions, same set of meaning infused into all of them. They were picked with specific reasons. But that's me saying what I hope for my son. Right? Getting a little leakage out here. That doesn't tell you who my son is. That tells you who I hope my son, some of who my son's background was, or will come, where he came from. In the Bible, you'll see children named based on some very interesting conventions sometimes. You're like, I don't know that I would have chosen to name my child Bitter because of the things that were going on at the time. But it links them to a point in history. This is what was happening at the time of your birth. This, or this is the situation in which you were raised, or this is the situation that your parents were living in when you were born or conceived or whatever. So there was meaning intended to be there. And then sometimes those names also mean things. Jesus' name, Yehoshua, in the long term, Yeshua short, means he who saves. So that one is pretty obvious and a pretty good fit too. So what we want, as I haven't said this, I maybe have said this before, but not to everybody in here. On their either 18th birthday or sometime around them, I'm intending to give my sons and now daughter a new name that they add. And that name is intended to reflect that the person that they have become. So in the same way that maybe that Peter was known as Simon for a while, and then nobody knows him as Simon. If you say Simon, one of the apostles, many of us kind of forget who, I forget who that is. Peter, Jesus renames him and says, I have a new name and role for you, it is Peter. So that doesn't mean that Seth's now going to have to go around telling people his name's Pete or whatever it is. But the idea is you give him a name that is meaningful to them, that tells them who you as a father have seen them grow up and be as a son. And hopefully it expresses something for their future too. But the bottom line is names are infused with meaning, usually by the parents. Some people get to name themselves. Actors pick their own screen or stage name or whatever it is. Some people will pick a title. If you're Alexander, maybe you just add the great to it. I don't think he added that himself, but he probably encouraged the practice. When you talk about, let me go back, let's see. Nope, I want to go to the first one. Actually, I do want to go to this one first. So I'm going to start with the reverse one first. Did somebody say something? Yes, sir.
So, because I'm in the same boat as you, looking at names, kind of reflecting off of what Genesis. And I just thought it was interesting that that's one of the few things that we do as parents that Adam did. That was kind of ascribed to Adam as a task, and that was good. And so somehow it was given a lot of, I mean, for the limited amount of actual words in Genesis in that time, there was a lot of words given to that. So I'm curious if that means there's some sort of extra significance or something. But
yeah, you know, I think that many people have thought what you're saying. First, you bring up a good point in that one of the initial tasks that Adam was given was naming the animals. That's kind of interesting. So coming up with names or things to call them was interesting, which is, I think, kind of a good challenge, an amazing challenge to begin with. I've heard the funny version of it being, parading him. If it happens all in one day, which I don't think it happened in a single 24-hour day, but if it happens all in one day, he's like, bear, giraffe, hippopotamus, crocodile, monkey, giraffe. Wait, did I say giraffe already? So it's that kind of humorous idea of how do you name things, what do they mean, and how are you, he's not just making up words. We don't just make up words. In fact, for those of you that haven't done kind of the etymology thing of looking into English, if you actually break English down, take the Latin and French and German and all the other things out of it, and you put them into modern English, our language sounds a little stupid occasionally. And the cool scientific names of that we think sound, you know, kind of imposing, Velociraptor, you know, that sounds like amazing. It means fast bird. And you're like, really? Fast bird of prey. Okay, got it. Or Tyrannosaurus Rex, king terrible lizard. So we start to sound like You know, sometimes people think that, that Native American sounds sound very primal or whatever else. English is the same way when you strip it back to the same language. It sounds a little bit, we name things by the way that they look or sound.
I think it's impressive, too, that he was able to remember all of them.
Right. You know? Did he write them down? Did he have language already? Right. Who knows? Yeah, good point. Peter's always good for one out of the sideline kind of corner questions. Okay, let's talk quickly about God's name. This is from Revelation chapter 19, and this is describing the rider on the white horse, who obviously we will know who he is pretty soon. But we start in verse 11, and it says, "Then I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, and his rider is called Faithful and True." In Spanish, by the way, anybody, when someone says, somebody educate us on Spanish, how do you introduce yourself in Spanish? Or Portuguese does the same thing,
say,
to my recollection.
I am called.
You don't say, in English we say, we might say, my name is, which is, that is to say, that is what I have been named. Sometimes you'll say, I'm Scott, which is contraction for I am Scott. But they do it properly in Spanish, and we do it properly occasionally. I am called that. That is the label that you use, but it doesn't encompass necessarily who I am. Its rider is called Faithful and True. With righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes like blazing fire and many royal crowns on his head. He has eyes like blazing fire and many royal crowns on his head. He has a name written on him that only he himself knows. He is dressed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God. So the Word of God, you know, this is John writing this one. Tradition tells us, and the same John that wrote the Gospel of John, which has that first chapter that talks about the Word in great detail. So this most interesting thing to me is he has a name written on him that only he himself knows. So think about that. Ponder what that might mean for a second. And then let's go to, where are we going? We're going to Exodus. This is not Exodus. Exodus chapter 3. And this is when, this is the burning bush and Moses. So Moses is getting his mission for the next several decades. And this is what he's told by God, who's identified himself out of the burning bush. And we'll skip down to verse 13, because I think most people are pretty familiar with this one, but you can read the context more if you wish. "Then Moses said to God, 'Behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?' God says to Moses, 'I am who I am.' And he said, 'Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am, has sent me to you.'" Now, he does then turn around, "Thus shall you say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you." So, more to be read here, but let's go back to when God says, "This is my name." Why do each, he uses "I am who I am." This can be translated in many ways. Acceptable translations include, "I am that I am," "I am that which I am," "I am what I am," "I will be who I will be," "I will be that I will be." So you can, both grammatically speaking, any of that can fit into to this right here. If we have a question about what are the purpose of names, why do we have different names in this room? What reasons do you think that we need different names in this room, or ought to have different names in this room?
It's like Dr. Seuss' story, "Too Many Daves."
Yeah, that's right. If everybody's name is Dave, or if everybody's name is John and Mary, it's John. Which John? This John. So by that is back in before we made up a lot of names, that was the problem. So how did we differentiate at the time? What was the easiest way? Son of, John, son of James, or Jesus, son of Joseph, or Isaac, son of Abraham. These kinds of son of thing, and if you go to the Middle East, does anybody know it? I'm picking an obvious one, not because it's a good one, but Osama bin Laden, do you know what his name means?
Probably Muhammad.
So, the bin part of it. So in Arabic, you'll hear Abu, which is father of. You'll hear, servant of. You'll hear, I'm going to get all these confused now. All the common titles that you hear that we think of as names often are in fact meaning servant of, or son of, or father of, or Sometimes you'll see mother of for women. U-M or U-M-M means mother of something. So often you might be named, known by the title of, let's say, Osama bin Laden, the son of Laden. So bin, B-I-N in Arabic, same as B-E-N in Hebrew. So Ben-Hur, Judah the son of Hur, Osama bin Laden, Osama the son of Laden. So you see, sometimes you'll see triple and quadruple identifications. The son of Abraham, the son of Isaac, the son of Jacob, the son of, or the other way, Jacob, son of Isaac, son of Abraham, kind of stuff. So you'll see these multiple identifications so that you can narrow down which John you mean, which Dave you mean, which person it is. And these are differentiators. It is a way to put a label on each of these bodies in here so that I know when you say Peter, that in this room, it means that guy. So I can say, I told Peter the following thing in solid ground. Now, everybody's mind is initially directed at the object that I'm talking about, Peter. God doesn't need that. It's not, there were not too many Daves before the creation of the world. There was one, and Dave, just what didn't do it. So why does he choose, this is God, he's speaking in a way that is going to be immemorialized forever. And this is his self-identification. He says, this is who you will know me as. This is who I am. Tell me why.
I think at the time, one of the things would be to differentiate himself from other things, to include other people's, you know, I guess people had different deities, different things, and he's saying, no, I am who I am. I am self-sustained. And it also talks about his, so the name may also include characteristics of who he is. So in that sense, I am who I am. I am self-sustaining. I am, and it's probably deeper than at some level that they realized at the time. Maybe not.
No, I do. I want to argue what you're arguing, which is are two things. One, when he goes down, he talks about other titles. I am the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Remember when Jacob goes and... one second, Peter, I'll hit you right after. When Jacob has decided that Laban, his father-in-law, is kind of getting to be on the edgy side, and he's decided, it's probably time, you know, I'm afraid of Esau. I don't want to go back and meet Esau because he may try to thump me. But Laban here, I'm not exactly welcome either, so he might try to thump. So better the guy I don't know than the threat that I know or something like that. So he decides he's going to leave. Rachel, so Leah and Rachel are Laban's daughters and wives of Jacob. What does Rachel steal? Anybody remember? The household gods, the household gods. Each person might have gods. I am the god of Peter. I am the god of Vio. I am the god. There are different gods that are out there. And so these are household deities almost. Now the word, you'll hear the Lord, and you also see in the Old Testament, Baal. And you say to yourself, Baal's bad, the Lord is good. Well, Baal, in these ancient languages, is how you say the Lord. So which Lord are you talking about? So Baal, God of the Ammonites, versus Baal, the real Baal, the real Lord, there has to be some differentiator in there. So you have heard the four-lettered name of God, which we pronounce, nobody really knows how it's pronounced for 100% for sure, but you'll hear said Yahweh, is something that you'll hear us say as Christians. Jews don't say it. Why don't Jews say it?
Too sacred.
Too sacred, too holy. The rabbis who do this as part of who they are, they don't write the word. They're not even supposed to think that pronunciation in their heads. They always substitute something else. I think that's a little bit overkill, because if God says, go tell the Israelites this is who I am, then I don't think he was like, and then tell them to wipe it from their memory. Break out the neuralizers and put something else in there. That's not what he meant. But good on Orthodox and Rabbinical Judaism and other forms of Judaism that recognize the holiness of this name. This name is unique. This name only applies to one, and it ought to be spoken of and thought of as a referent of the Almighty in a way that is higher than when you're referring to Scott or Peter or Vio or anything else. It ain't the same thing. So good on them for getting that part. Maybe, in my opinion, and who am I, a little bit of overkill. But the Lord is a placeholder. And the other one that you'll hear a lot is Hashem, is what they'll call him. It means God. It means the name. So they will talk about, you know, we are children, we are servants of, or we are the people of Hashem, the name. This occurs a lot in songs. It occurs a lot in literature. Peter, and then.
Yeah, the way he says it there, I am who I am, in the context of what you were talking about with son of or dad of, looks like he's just saying I am of me, basically.
That's right. There is no Ben here. There is no son of or a derivative at all. And this is maybe the first point. In fact, this is the point to aseity, which is God is self-existent. And I want to draw more out of it than that, but that is a basic, if you get no other point here of a philosophical point, it's that God is self-existent. He is dependent on nothing. In philosophical language, we would say he exists necessarily. He doesn't exist contingently. He doesn't depend on anything else for his existence. He's the creator of the universe, but the universe depends on him, not the other way around. If you wipe out the universe, God's still there. There is nothing that you can take away that doesn't leave God. He is self-existent. And we'll talk about what always existed means, but we'll say this, he always exists. There is no time that you can make the statement, God does not exist, and that's true. Any time that you make the statement, God exists, it is always true, even if you're not there to make it, and God's the only one there to make it. Yes, sir.
I wanted to kind of draw out the context of what this is being said, because I've always found this to be like brilliant. And you have the other gods that are written about in ancient texts, and they're the gods of make my harvest good and these small household deities, right? And we have this within the context. You know, we know for certain that the age of this text, this is way above and beyond what other gods are like. In ancient manuscripts.
Yeah, he brings up a point that I've always found really, really compelling. In fact, a friend of mine, I just had lunch with him this week. He just brought exactly this point up. He loves to bring up the point. He's an atheist, and he says, "How many gods do you think there have been since the inception of man?" You know, and I'm like, 500 million. He's like, "That seems like a lot." I'm like, "There's 300 million in Hinduism alone, so you know, we're already 3/5 of the way there, and I've only done one." All of them, though, have this. They have a domain, but that domain is always limited. This concept of God, and by the way, I'm only taking you to one point in here. I've skipped, and maybe I shouldn't, but go to this transcript on Reasonable Faith and watch Dr. Craig expound the places in the Bible where the prophets of Israel mock these other gods as these little deities, and they're like, you guys aren't even, it's not even the same league, it's not even the same sport. You're not even the same planet as this God is. You're not even the same universe this God is. And so this Hebrew concept of God is so non-standard compared to every other ancient concept of God that it ought to suggest something. I'm not saying it's too big for the human imagination, but philosophers are still arguing about this one today, and nobody feels like they've got a wrap on it. So, but everybody feels like they pretty much got Zeus contained, right? Nobody's like, wow, there's just more to the concept of Zeus than I can really get my head around. It's really hard to work with. No, it's not. The guy's just a completely out of control president who got more powers. That's not necessarily a current reference. That could be a reference to a lot of things that happened earlier. Yes, sir. Say that again.
Does Yahweh mean I am?
So Yahweh is what you also hear called the tetragrammaton, the four letters. It's basically, when you transliterate them in the Latin, you get YHWH. That is what we think is the short version, or that is the written version of just I am. So this part right here, I am who I am, is three words long in ancient Hebrew, to my understanding. So Yahweh just means I am. So, and when he says this, I am who I am, tell them I am has sent you. That I am that you see in all caps is the tetragrammaton. Vio, I'm sorry, I skipped you.
This is what I want to emphasize, because in Hebrew language is repeat of the word. It's HVH.
Right.
And then in Greek language is coming alpha and omega. And the Lord is the vector, you know. And if you looked at that in Hebrew language, when we addressed to Moses, I am who I am, for them was enough, you know. But for the Greek, for them, the mentality and the philosophy, they must all the time they believe in circle, you know. So that's the reason in the alphabet, the Greek people put alpha, the first, and omega, as the last one. And all the other letters there between alpha and omega. If we read in the Hebrews, in the Old Testament, it's I am who I am, like this. If we go there to New Testament, it's from the beginning to the end, I am existing and I sustain this.
Yes. Yeah, now we'll talk about that part. God, so some of what Vio is talking about, we'll get to in later Doctrine of God stuff, but he's talking about the names are bookends to anything. Beginning, end, first, last. The concept that the Bible is trying to get across to us that this carries within itself is, you know, if you're drawing lines of existence or lines in which they exist, you know, you've got some axis T here that's supposed to represent time, and maybe it goes in this direction, or maybe it starts at some point and keeps going in this direction. God's timeline is, at a minimum, the same as whatever your maximal timeline is. And then you can, once you start arguing differently than that, you kind of have to change the paradigm in which you're talking a little bit. But the bottom line is this: there is no point at which you're not going to find this God. Where there is a point where you're not going to find pretty much everything else or anything else, any given thing that you're looking for. With maybe some exceptions, and we'll talk about that next time, or if we roll this one in the next class, we're going to talk a little bit about Platonism and about if there is anything else other than God that exists necessarily or self-sufficiently or has to exist.
I was just going to ask, what is God's relationship to abstract objects? Is that part of this?
Stand by for next time. That is our teaser trailer for next class. We're going to talk about the threat of Platonism. I mean that term broadly because they can coexist. Modern famous philosopher Peter Van Inwagen is a modern Platonist and Christian who believes that God and abstract objects both exist necessarily. And I don't pretend to understand entirely where he comes from on this one, but maybe because I'm mentally blocked a little bit because I disagree with some of the assumptions. But there are Christians who are Christian Platonists. In fact, some people argue that a lot of the philosophy that we see that seems to be in early Christian writing has a heavy Greek influence, and heavy Greek influence just is Platonic and Aristotelian thought. That's part of what that means in many cases. So, Platonic forms, yes. Whether those, and we'll talk more about it next time. But yes, that's what we're talking about. Okay. Did I see another hand up? Did I miss one? Okay. So, God is going to identify Himself, and what does He tell us in here? One, that He's self-existent. So maybe the second part is anything else that we're going to say about God is going to be describing things that God does. So we call Him faithful and true, right? That means He's shown Himself to be faithful and true. It may be the case. So I want to go to an alternate wording of this. One of the other acceptable wordings of this is, I will be who I will be. Some people have asked this question. Remember I said we have two tools to look at who God is, scriptures and perfect being theology. Perfect being theology is this idea that God is the greatest of all possible beings. There's even an argument that comes out of that one that not everybody's a fan of. But ultimately, perfect being theology is a way to conceive of God. If God really is the greatest possible being, if there is no being, there is nothing that He lacks that is good. He has all, philosophers say, great making properties. He is the ultimate good. There is nothing that He doesn't have that a great being we would conceive of would need. Then if He says, one of the questions you have to ask yourself is, does He have to be that way? So God exists necessarily. That is to say, it's not possible that God not exist. Does He have to be the way that He is?
So there's that dilemma, which is God, is there some definition of God, of good, that God has to ascribe to as well, thus it being higher than God, or is God sort of arbitrary, and therefore good is not really, it's just something that God defined at some point in time?
Yes, so this comes out of one of Plato's dialogues. We're going to come back to Plato a lot around here, called the Euthyphro, and the Euthyphro dilemma is exactly what he's describing, and I'm going to get it wrong exactly how they say it, but something like, if the gods, and they talk about the gods as a panoply or kind of a group, if God or the gods, if what they say is good because they say it, then it's arbitrary what is good. They could have designated rape and murder as good if they wanted to, But they don't. They say something else is. But otherwise, if what they say is good, if they're just acknowledging that which actually is good, then something else, namely the good, exists already. And because that exists and they're just recognizing it, the gods are recognizing it, that's the higher thing. The good is the higher thing. So it's called the horns of the dilemma. The dilemma is this: either God isn't the ultimate, or the gods are not ultimate, or whatever the gods pronounce as moral realities are arbitrary, and they could have picked anything else they want to. Now there is when you're fixed on the horns of a dilemma and an argument, you always want to find a third way, if there is a third way, so that you're not stuck. The third way Christian theologians frequently talk about this, or maybe the only way that I've heard, I think it's the only way that I've ever heard, is to say, God doesn't, is neither. It's neither in God's case. He pronounces things that are good based on his own character. So he is good, and so he says, because this is who I am, this is what is good. So it is not arbitrary. He can't turn around and say, I am faithful, I am true, but I am going to pronounce what's good to be faithless and false. He doesn't do that because, being the ultimate being that he is. So that's the answer to the Euthyphro, but that's exactly, he brings up the great point, which is that is a way to solve this one. But I want to go even one step further and say this. Does God's character have to be a perfect being? Maybe another way to put it is, does he have any choice about being good? Does he have any choice about being faithful? Does he have any choice about being true? Or does he have to do that because that's what his nature is? I think there's a really good answer to this one, but I want to see what we think here. Peter, did you have something?
I was just going to say, he says it because he is good.
Yes. Yes, that's the short version of the solution to the Euthyphro dilemma. That's right.
I'll draw this out for a quick second because when I understand it, this makes me praise God.
Okay.
So the answer is, maybe it depends, but, you know, if you're doing the maximum being theology, I can see how that necessitates kind of the good, therefore he has to. But I don't know if that's necessarily true. I just don't know. It could be that he could do what he wants, and somehow that is what it's. We just don't know. But the fact that he chooses, or whatever, the fact that he has, in his being and his self-will, decided to value justice and good, makes me rejoice because I see so much evil in the world, and I'm glad that there is going to be an account. I'm glad that there is something that's going to come to existence to kind of call the spade the spade, and because of that and many other things, it's another reason to think about it and say, praise God.
Amen to that. And so I'm going to pull, this is a good point, let me pull one of the threads of what he's just saying here, and this is actually the method of perfect being theology, is when you try to say, it's a project of saying, let's build what God is based on conceptions. So we might say, you know, we start off with this idea that God is the greatest possible being. And so now we can, because that's the way that we think of God, that's the way that we are saying that we're going to think of God, we can start to ask a series of questions. Is it better to be just? Is it greater to be just or unjust? Well, the answer is just. Okay, so is it greater to be a little just? Or all or maximally just? And the answer is maximally just. So now we start to get nouns, and then we can start to get adjectives, and those lead us to think. Now, not all properties are great-making properties. Is it greater for God to be green or blue? Well, you know, unless you have a favorite color, and that favorite color is like an objective reality, then it ought to be a favorite color, then it doesn't matter. So God need not have a property that isn't a great-making property. Okay. So looking for great-making properties is how we build, one way that we can build our concept of God. So now, and Matt, think of it this way. And this is, I think, the answer to this potential dilemma of like, well, God has to be that way. It's another Euthyphro dilemma. If he has to be all just, he didn't have a choice about being what he is. Let me ask you a question. Which is greater? of these two. Now, to me, the answer is intuitively obvious. A God that chooses to be good rather than one that's bound by his nature to be good, this, I don't think so, is the case. So I think if you argue against this idea that God simply is that way because he has to be that way by nature, one, you've taken God's free will away. And if you ask the question, which is it greater to be have a being with free will, or is it greater to be a being that has no free will? I think we ourselves would say, I would rather have free will. I think it's greater to have free will than to be a robot. I mean, there's a lot of movies that explore this topic, maybe not in this form. But to me, this is the way that we know, this is the way to argue that God is, now let's take this back to, that God is the greatest possible being, or rather, I should say, that's not right. One of the properties that the greatest possible being ought to have, to me, is that he gets to self-determine what his character is, that he is self-existent. Now, if you, and as soon as I make this point, I'll get right to you. If this right here is if this right here is translated, I will be who I will be, or I will be what I will be, that is to say that it is God who chooses, not what his essential properties are, where his essential properties are ones that he had, that may just reduce to self-existence, that he is the I am, but that the properties and how he relates to others are properties of his choice. Sarah.
And Jesus says, you know you're my Father because you know me. And so one of the things that we see about Jesus is the fact that he does get to choose, especially when Satan takes him into the desert, or he goes into the desert and Satan meets him and tempts him with at least four things that we know of. And, you know, when you say tempted, so it means that it had to have been something he kind of wanted to do. And then also in the garden, when Jesus says, you know, give me a different choice. Is there another way that we can save our people?
Right.
But I'll do what you want.
Yes.
So through knowing Jesus and the fact that he can choose to do those things, we know his Father who chooses what's best for us, I guess.
Great point. And so that nobody thinks that we're going to attempt to exhaust how to know God just in the doctrine of God portion of it. When we get to doctrine of Christ, if Christ, the Christian doctrine is that Christ and God are the same in some way, they may not be numerically identical, they may be, but usually we conceive of them as not, but the idea is that they are, that Jesus is the Son of God at a minimum, whatever that means, but if Jesus is God, it also seems to be supported in the New Testament. We'll talk about what that is, but we will also talk about getting to know God by knowing Christ, because a great way to get to know somebody is listen to what they have to say about themselves. Anybody who's married knows this is the truth. Another great way to do it is to see what they do when they come and visit you. Right? Isn't that, don't you kind of want to know both? You want to hear what people have to say about themselves. Imagine you're speed dating. You speed date with somebody. We're speed dating with God right now, right? Because we're just reading a little bit of stuff and trying to figure out if this is someone we want to have a relationship with. Let's say that's your conundrum. That's your problem. That's the thing that you're trying to do. You listen. I've never speed dated. I understand it's something like you sit across from the table and there's some very limited period of time in which you talk to each other about yourself. So you're trying to tell the person as much as you can. And when you look at how much the Bible is, if you're talking about an almighty creator of all things, and this is all the data you have on him, that's kind of the equivalent of here's 2 minutes on who I am. And then you have to make a choice of whether you want to get to know that person. Nobody is going to say, you know what, this was a 5-minute speed dating session. I listened to him for 5 minutes. That's the person for me. Show me, what do you got on your calendar? What looks good for marriage? You know, that's not normally the way things are done. Even in arranged marriage places, that's usually not the way things are done. The people meet and talk for several hours together frequently, or they have known each other previously. So if we want to get to know somebody, it's okay to listen to what they have to say about themselves. But I'm going to steal from C.S. Lewis, who in his book, The Horse and His Boy, Shasta, the kid, has made it to Archen Land. He's wandering around, and he kind of ends up lost in the woods. And a couple of dwarves take him in prior to all the excitement that's going to come. And during that period of time, one of them uses a quote as though it's an old maxim, "Come, live with me, and you'll know me." Where the idea isn't just listen to me talk to you about myself. But when you experience life with me, you'll get to see me in the high times, the low times. You'll get a better understanding of my character. That, to me, and fast forwarding a little bit, is who Jesus is. God says, if you want to get to know me, let me show you what my character would be like if I were human. And this is what you get with Jesus. Maybe that is a very incomplete and inaccurate description, but it's at least an interesting idea of, we're going to talk about God and the doctrine of God from the, what can we derive from what we know, but then there's an experiential way to know God, not only in Jesus, but I think further. And we'll talk about that too. Yes, ma'am.
That's the reason that it says your children will do not what you teach them, but what they see you doing.
Yes, and if you don't think that's the case, one of the times that you think you get parenting right, somebody tell me if you're surprised by this, but my house is wired for AV, and we monitor our kids via video, you know, baby camera and all that kind of stuff. One of my favorite clips, and we somehow managed to save it. My son, Seth, takes one of his teddy bears, goes to the rocking chair and rocks it for his analog of what a few minutes would be, carries it gently to the bed, lays it down, tucks it in exactly the way that we tuck it down, and bends down and kisses it, and then goes and sleeps on the floor. Minus the last part, which we don't often do. This is a kid who's treating an inanimate object this way. He is very much aping what he has seen his parents do. And sometimes even the inflection, the voice, I'm trying to remember what he said to me the other day. He goes, "Oh, Dada, that's correct." And I'm like, "Where did he get that? Where do you think he got that?" So they are imitators, strong imitators. And this is why Jesus' word for God is Papa, is Daddy. It is a very much God has bothered to go to the trouble of being a father to the same way, which I think is a pretty, pretty neat thing. Find me another God that does that kind of thing.
I apologize for taking us away from the sentimental lessons of parenting.
That's all right. I'll probably max the sentiment out anyway.
Could you go back to your earlier point about whether it is greater to choose to be good or whether it is better to be good by nature?
Yes.
Does that lead to an infinite regress?
So I don't think so, because when... So forgive me for a brief departure in the philosophical talk. If you go back to God with a set of necessary properties.
So, Scott, I'm actually missing the point of how that would be infinite regress. Can you...
Yeah,
is it better to be a God who chooses to be good or a God who chooses to choose to be good?
Right.
And in that case, is it better to be a God who chooses to choose to choose to be good? And you can see that could lead to an infinite regress and then by...
There's that problem, and I was also rolling into your objection, another possible one, which is kind of a chicken or the egg problem of... Well, God has to have some set of properties already. So if he exists necessarily, is he necessarily all just? Is he necessarily all loving? Is he necessarily all good, whatever that means? If all good is identical with that which is his nature, then those are identical, and that's a meaningless distinction. But how does he exist and then turn around and give himself essential properties, which you can't do? So in either version, thank you, Carl, for clarifying the question, but in either version of those, you have to ask the question of what are God's essential traits as he exists, now back to our philosophical term, a se, which is just fancy for by himself. So just God, I can't remember, I don't think I've got the, I'll redraw it. For those that have seen where we did the Trinity paper, you'll remember a set of diagrams where I kind of had a dot here, and then I had lines possibly going off in any direction. These were possible worlds, or these were particularly world tracks that have their own separate and distinct timeline that runs at different rates. I also drew it as a series of dots where, like, okay, here's God existing necessarily. I don't know why this is doing it that way. Here's God existing necessarily. Then here's the next instant in time. I realize that we're kind of doing this quantum as though these are supposed to be points, mathematical, give it whatever your definition is. But basically, here's these points. This is the point we're concerned about right here. This is the first point of God's existence, if you want to talk about it that way. If God did not begin to exist, then this is the eternal state in which God exists prior to doing something. So if this is God in aseity. This may be t equals zero. I argue that this is not the way that it is. And then maybe universe starts at that point. So there's a point here where the universe exists and God exists. There's a point here where God exists and the universe does not exist. So there's a lot that can be said about this. So I'm skipping a ton of it. I base my paper in the realities of what this is. But ultimately, this is what we're talking about. This part right here of God existing, where the only properties God's going to have here, the only things we can use to describe him here, are what he is essentially. Let me give you an example to take this out of the abstract. At this point right here, is God the creator of the universe? Well, there is no universe. So he's not the creator of the universe. Maybe you can say he will be the creator of the universe, or if any universe is going to be created, he's the guy that's going to ultimately have done it or be at the back of it. But he hasn't created the universe yet. So to say at that point, if you could say at that point, if it were possible to say at that point, is God the creator of the universe? The answer is no. So the value at this point of the point, unless it's assigned to his character, that is to say he's and will create. But at that point, that's like saying, you're right in an ultimate sense, in an eventual sense. But I think in the ultimate sense, you can say this. Think about Barack Obama at 19 years old. Is Barack Obama the president of the United States? He is different, but the idea is if it's temporally or causally prior, if temporal or causally prior, then he doesn't yet have that property. He will have that property, but at the time of at 19, Barack doesn't have that property. At this point right here, which I've now overdrawn, God does not yet have the property of being the creator. Now, to your point, there is a set of properties that God has that will work themselves out in any of these points that come out. So I like the idea of being all-loving or omnibenevolent. I think that is an essential property of God. I think God is omnibenevolent. And what does that mean? Now, that means he has the property that when he regards other things, that he will want good for those things. Now, if the good is defined by, now we're going to run into a bit of a circular definition here, good is defined by the regard that God has for things, then all we're really saying is God will regard things the way that God regards things. Now, maybe we're back to one horn of the Euthyphro dilemma of being like, well, then he's just kind of made it up as to whatever he wants to be. So some of that we'll put aside for right now. Yes, Al?
Yeah, I did have a problem with God chooses to be good, and then on the other hand, God is good solely because of his nature. And you have to have that qualifier solely, because without that, you could have it both. You could have God chooses to be good, and it is his nature. And if we added another qualifier to the first one and said God chooses to be good independent of his nature, that we would have to X out both of them.
So right? That's a good. So that brings up or helps sharpen the point that I'm trying to make. Okay. What are some of the things? What are some? We'll say God's. We're going to make a quick. We'll start our list. Essential properties. Now this is something we're going to be adding to possibly over several classes. That's now an I. God's essential properties. One, self-existent. That's the one we're talking about today. So that is to say, he doesn't depend on anything else in order to exist. He self-exists. So he is. That's what the at a minimum, that's what the I am means, is that I'm the self-existent one. What else do we think about God? Back here at this point, what else do we think is a property of God that he has? I'll add another one on there. Yes, sir, Vio, go ahead. I'll write this while you say.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Okay, so God has free will. Now, if he has free will, he's probably also personal. If he wasn't personal, he's just kind of a state. He's kind of the ultimate being, the ultimate, not being, he's the ultimate reality, but that reality is not a personal being. If that reality is not a personal being, then what power does it have to change or to bring things into existence? Something has to go from that state of being to now a state where that being is bringing other things into being. That to go from one to the other, either that's been happening eternally, in which case we should see an eternity of kind of creation stuff going on, or it has to somehow have a mechanism for selection of turning on and off the I'm creating universes thing. So if that's the case, we can at least infer, this isn't a deduction at this point, it's an inference, maybe. You can frame it as a deduction, but you got to put an axiom in there, that God is personal.
When you mean personal, do you mean essentially that he has a mind?
Yes, that's all. Peter, and then Vio. Okay, so now this is interesting. I think you're right, omniscience.
I have to disagree.
Okay, fire away. I'll put a question mark there now because we have a disagreement.
So the way I would draw it, if you're going to include omniscience, is God on one plane of existence and time in another. Because I'm thinking omnipresent, omniscient, being able to see through all time. And if you, it seems like the way we're drawing it, we're describing him constrained in this environment by formlessness or time.
So you're going to have to hold both of those, unfortunately, till later. Amazingly, you can't cover God in a single class. We have a doctrine of God part where we talk about omniscience. We have one where we talk about omnipotence. Each has individual properties. We need to break those out in there. We just can't do them justice in here. But let's put question marks on them since we'll leave those under a little bit of debate. But we'll at least say this, in this state right here, if potent simply means has the capacity for, this is a set of capacities, then we might want to say, yeah, we think the ultimate being would have the capacity to do anything that he freely chooses to do. Now, this is interesting for the following reason. What good does it do to ascribe to God the property of being loving if there's not another creature, thing, for God to love? It's like saying that he's, you know, I have the ability to be a father, but before I have any kids, I am not a father. That doesn't make me a father. That makes me potentially a father. That's, to me, that same relationship exists for God because we as contingent beings are not necessarily existent. We're not eternal. There is some point into which we came into being. So God has not been my Lord. God was not the Lord of Scott prior to my existence. He was the Lord of everything else that existed, but if I didn't exist at that point, then he's not my Lord until the point where I exist, at which point he becomes, now we could say he necessarily becomes my Lord, but there are possible worlds that I don't exist in where he's not the Lord of Scott because Scott doesn't exist. Okay, then that's not a necessary and essential property because there exists a possible world in which God does not have that property.
I think the Trinity brings in a lot of
There are a lot of guys that make this argument, and you're on the side of some very distinguished Oxford and Cambridge scholars who say this. Now, I unfortunately am arguing with that point of view, but the naive estimate is that those guys are probably right. Okay, you have to hear my argument as to see whether I think that God existing eternally as a Trinity has other objects for love and therefore can be omnibenevolent. All right, fine. Let's grant that as a possibility. At least a possibility. I'm trying to argue it's not a possibility. It was granted as a possibility. It doesn't really, in my opinion, it only buys you an actual existing omnibenevolence. So God's omnibenevolent. He's omnipotent in that he has all these potential. But when you say he's omniscient, what does he know? So I think there are at least two forms. I don't. Other people think there are two forms of knowledge. I agree. One of them is knowing propositional truths. Roller coasters are scary. That's a propositional assertion. Experientially, if I've never been on a roller coaster, I don't know that truth the same way that somebody who's been on a roller coaster knows that, or something like that. You know, or being a father is wonderful, or being in love is terrific. So you don't know. You can say, yeah, being in love is terrific. I've read a lot about it. I understand it's a good thing. This is the Good Will Hunting argument. You remember Robin Williams says to Good Will Hunting, you don't know anything, and I'm going to edit it, you don't know anything that you haven't read in a book somewhere because you haven't experienced these things in life. And experiential knowledge is different than propositional knowledge. So at this point, I would say God has all propositional knowledge. And I want to include in that set knowledge of all possible future events and all contingent future events. If there's a guy named Steve that exists, then on whatever today's date is, Steve will have eggs for breakfast. That's a propositional truth, a contingent propositional truth that depends on Steve's free will. I think God even has that kind of knowledge. Some people think that he doesn't. Open theists say God doesn't know the future because he can't for these other set of reasons or whatever else. But the bottom line is I want to include in this omniscience at this point, at this first point right here, God knows all things that are and will be in any kind of possible world. So I think that's the set of his truth. What God doesn't have there is experiential knowledge. But it's not logically possible to have experiential knowledge prior to an event. So it's not necessary that an omniscient being have experiential knowledge before experiences can be had because it's just simply logically impossible. So you'll see that there is the set of all possible knowledge that includes experiential knowledge that God can't logically have. He can only have propositional knowledge, and then he has to fill in the experiential knowledge. Well, how does he fill in experiential knowledge? Well, one is he has experience, but by sustaining the universe, and we'll talk about this more. Maybe God can also have experiential knowledge. We'll talk about what that looks like.
No one can have
all experiential knowledge because one can't be everybody. Although Randy has asked a question that maybe is an argument that you could say, well, if we all really aren't individual, we think that we're individual minds, but in fact we're not, we're all part of God's mind or something like that. Maybe God is having all these experiences, but then I think that runs into, he didn't posit that as an argument, he posed that as a question. I think there's an answer to that, we'll get to that when we talk about omniscience.
Like God could experience sin then, if that were true.
Right, so that's something logically impossible because this is God willing to do something against his own will, right? So, interesting. We'll talk about this more later. Vio.
Yeah, when we talk about that, what was happening before the time, God is light, and he's the father of lights. And he says, I don't tempt, and I cannot be tempted,
yep.
Because he preferred to be full,
yes,
100% in our mind, and it is in the light. There, before the time, the Satan choose, and here is coming the point, God can choose or no, he cannot choose, because he decides who it is. But Satan choose, when he choose, he subtract from the light. He and a lot of angels.
Can withdraw. Yeah, right.
Yeah, they come out. And in that moment, they create anarchy, or in that moment, they create the ways of unobedience.
Yes.
And after that, well, is come the creation, the man is coming in the time, day and night. And the man has the possibility to choose. I choose the day working,
yep.
That's meaning in the presence of God, or I choose in the night.
Yes.
But in the end, is going to be the judge. And everybody that in this time of the creating the universe, day and night, you know, everybody is going to be judged if they like to be in the light or they like to be in the darkness. But very nice, it's beautiful, is written here in Revelation, there is going to be a city without
night,
darkness.
Yeah. It's God who is the light to all the time.
That's the reason that for this temporary, God is recommending, I'm omni. Do we must tell to the angel that God is omnipotent? No, because they
know
very
right.
Well. For we who are in this period of time, we need this kind of names. And it's good because we talk about this, you know, to know him much better, much better. How he know him much better, much better, we decided to stay much more in light. And that kind of diminutive, little just or something like that, it's gone. How much we decide to be in the light on God's presence.
So I think Vio's point underscores, you know, in symbolic terms here, where the Bible frequently uses the terms light to talk about knowledge, to talk about goodness, to talk about who God is, all that kind of stuff. You might say, well, if there's light and there's darkness, and darkness is defined as a place where God kind of is not, then that doesn't that mean that God's not the greatest possible being? Because now he could be everywhere, but now he's not in the places where there's darkness. So this isn't supposed to be a physical representation. It's a representation of a spiritual one or something. It's a metaphor. But in this metaphor, even if you use a metaphor as kind of a physical idea, possible is the important thing. It's not logically possible to be somewhere that you're not, that kind of thing, or to be somewhere that you've chosen to be absent from. So although there's going to be some spatial problems when we talk about this in terms of space and time, which we talk about later when we talk about omnipresence and that kind of thing.
Psalm says that the darkness is like
the light
of the Lord.
So, yeah. Right. Salt. Okay, done. Thank you, David and God. Okay, so let me wrap this up for today. Maybe we'll roll into this a little bit next time too, and then get into Platonism a little bit too. But what I want to, in fact, we will do this next time because I love this topic and we're only half done with it, unless anybody objects. When we're talking about who God is, what God is as his essential properties, as his essential traits, if he has not created Well, let's pretend that, what you're looking at right here is the entirety of the universe. This is it. All he's done is this box, this rectangle of a room, and this is it. This is all this is all the creatures that are in it. Interestingly, we're moral agents. We seem to have free will. We seem to be independent minds, at least seem to be. We seem to be to exist. We seem to not be self-existent. We seem to be created by God or caused in some way by God. So all this stuff is here. This is the universe God has created. This is all that there is. How does God regard us? How does God regard us? I ask you this question. How do you know what love is? How do you know what love is? I say, you love your wife, you love your husband, you love your father or your mother, or I love you. How do you know what that means?
I think first, you've been loved, so you are exposed to the love, you experience love, and then you can love somebody else.
You're giving a name. She's right. I think you're given a name. I'm making this discussion shorter. We'll do this more later, too, if you want, the next time. You are naming something that already exists. So what happens is God makes us, and he has a particular regard for us. And we watch what that looks like, and we say, you know what? I can't think of a way to treat me better than the way that God does. That's kind of the ultimate nice thing to be. It makes me the most happy. I'm going to call that love. There wasn't love out there and God conformed to it. We are talking about the way that God regards us, and it so happens to be love. Now, that's dangerously close to subjective. Maybe it does fix you on the horns of the Euthyphro dilemma. I still think that the third option applies more strongly than does the Euthyphro option. But if so, if it is subjective, so what? If the subjective good morals are solely what God sets, well, if this God treats us as nicely as it seems to me that God does for those that love him and those that want to know him, I'm perfectly happy with that. In fact, I'm hard-pressed to think of a greater being, a being that could have regarded me less but chooses to regard me so much that he takes on human form, gets excruciatingly killed for my sake just so that I can be around him when I don't deserve it. And he probably could have created somebody who didn't do this kind of stuff that I do. Find me a better God than that. I'll serve that one. But you're going to be good luck. Peter, and this will be the last word, and then we're going to have to split.
When the Bible says God is love, that seems to go beyond just that he has love, right? Or that he is loving. It's like, it seems that it is an essential part of him. You know what I mean?
I agree, and I'll be that I'm personally, I'm in a little bit of split mind as to whether, I haven't made up my mind yet as to whether, I mean, the Bible is not a philosophy textbook. Is that meant to be, it's not an identity relationship. But is it supposed to be as descriptive as you're saying? I think yes, maybe it could be. But I also think, well, maybe it's a descriptor that's supposed to be taken less thoroughly as we might want to take it. At a minimum, the minimum point of agreement is that God is omnibenevolent and as a perfect being. So yes, this is a good point. We will explore this one when we get to omnibenevolence too. Okay. Now let me wrap this up because I wanted to tell, there are two things that I'll say at the end here because I want every class, and we're doing too little of it at this class, but this is the hardest one to do it in, and we'll do more of it at the end of the next class, which is a continuation of this class. I want to at every time say why this property or understanding of who God is matters to us on a practical level. Aseity, God's self-existence. We take it for granted, people who have had God as our God for a long time, how foundational God is. If Zeus, you're serving Zeus, you're worried that one of Zeus's kids does to him what he does to, was it Kronos? Who?
Kronos.
So you want an ultimate foundation that will never, ever change. The Judeo-Christian God simply is that. And as far as I can tell, he's the only one. You can maybe make a case for kind of a Zoroastrian one. In my opinion, the Muslim concept of God is derivative of this one, so it's the same. In that sense, he's still self-existent. He's still the creator of the universe, although those properties remain the same. How he interacts with man changes in Islam compared to the Judeo-Christian faith. But ultimately, this concept of who God is, if that God exists, the one thing you don't have to worry about is something happening that he can't control. And the second thing you don't have to worry about is whether he's going to get ultimately put in a metaphysical headlock by somebody else. Whatever this guy says goes. Okay, we'll talk about it in much more detail next time, but the thing to feel secure on is if in your lives you ever get to the point, there are people in this church who've talked about, I'm yelling at God, I'm angry with God, this kind of stuff, That's properties that have to do with the way that God is interacting with them, they think. But you never have to worry whether God is going to be able to do what it is that he says he can do. So next week, maybe we can start to talk about what does God say he will do, and does he kind of have to stick to that? That's another set of properties. But this is the most philosophical of the classes. If this has been a little bit too much for you, don't worry, it'll get less than that, or at least sustained. But think about it until next time, and let's talk more in detail about what does God's name mean, and what is it, and who does that say that he is? Thank you very much for your time, and we'll see you next time.